The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. Support the show by donating at patreon.com/movementspod. Ahoy, comrades. Oh boy, it has been a wild ride since I last spoke to you all. If you listened to the last episode that I did with Adam Patterson, you know that there was a mixture of excitement at the time, but also a substantial amount of fear, not knowing what was going to happen. And here we are. I'm recording this Sunday afternoon on June 7th, approximately 8 days after my conversation with Adam was recorded. And it's just, you know, that Lenin quote, and, you know, it may be apocryphal. I don't actually know the origin of where this quote was originally cited. But the Lenin quote comes to mind, that there are decades when nothing happens, and then there are weeks when decades happen. And I feel like the last week has been one of those times. You know, the first few days of this uprising, it felt like, you know, we knew it was going to be something different. It was even by that second night, it was just simply astounding what had been accomplished. And here we are. I've lost track of count at this point, how many days since the uprising began. And it's a new world. And, you know, before, you know, I don't want to take too much time before I get to this incredible conversation that I had with Doug Ina Green, a Marxist historian and published author, author of A Communist Insurgent, a biography of August Blanqui, as well as the author of a forthcoming book on the life of Michael Harrington, who actually will be the topic of today's conversation and a launching point for our conversation to then later on we'll talk about Bernie Sanders and you know, what is to be done wink wink about socialism in America today, given that we may have, I don't want to jinx us, but I deeply suspect that we've entered a period of American history that would be considered pre-revolutionary. What happens next, whether or not that revolution is successful, you know, I don't know. I don't want to make any assumptions, but things are different. That's all I can say about that. But anyway, I don't want to just go rambling on too long. So much has happened. I'm wanted to let you everybody know. So first time listeners, and I think I may have some new listeners who have never listened to either The Movement's core show, which is The Movement's Meat and Potatoes show, is our history series that we do. And we've done a history series on a number of topics, including the Spanish Civil War and the Russian Revolution, the colonization of Palestine. I'm currently at the moment working on a series on the history, the revolutions in Guatemala and Cuba, and how they changed Latin America in the 20th century. So those are the meat and potatoes, but occasionally I like to do these episodes where we just chat about stuff with smart, sharp, cool, rad people about whatever it is their field of expertise. And we like to call those Stalin for time, because the history shows are labor intensive and they take forever to produce. So this is a great way of continuing to educate, continuing to stimulate thought and creativity among my listeners. But I also wanted to let you know, if you're one of the listeners who only subscribes to this feed but does not follow me on Facebook or Twitter, you've missed out on a lot. As a result of the events of the last 2 weeks, I've been receiving the most interest I've ever received in my work, and it's just been an incredible series of days. And I've gone into ad hoc organizer mode. I've been sleeping very little for the past week. I'm currently working on making sure that You know, I'm able to get sleep and be healthy and all those good things. But there's definitely been a rush that I've been feeling, and I've been organizing a number of projects. So make sure to follow Facebook and Twitter so that you don't miss out. We're doing a mixture of educational and also practical trainings, some webinars. I have a number of volunteers, close contacts of mine with expertise in a number of fields, including public defense, public defenders, U.S. Army veterans, U.S. Navy doctors, folks who have had experiences in police abolition or restorative justice. And we're working just on so much material right now. And close and to my heart is, many of you probably don't know that, I don't know if I've ever talked about this, but my origins are as actually a stage actor. That's where I come from originally. There was a sort of learning curve for learning how to perform for the microphone, how to voice act for this show. But that's my background, and I've reconnected with a number of old theater colleagues, professional stage managers, actors, even a composer, a professional composer, who I'm now in talks with on a number of more video content, which I never really did before this past week. So the YouTube channel, Movements Pod, you know, it's a thing now. There is currently a short video, an excerpt from The Russian Revolution Part 3 that I perform live. Specifically, I provide a little bit of historical context at the beginning of the video, and then for about 22 minutes, I live perform the excerpt telling the story of the fall of Tsar Nicholas II. So I think we have so many projects in new types of content, new types of material that I'm going to be producing. The core of the show will remain the long-form audiobook-style history shows because it's important to me that this show remains scholarly, and that form allows me to go deep into the details and to read multiple sources, cross-reference, learn a little bit more about the historiography of the topic, become familiar with who are the major historians of each topic, all that sort of nerdy stuff, details, so that I can... Apparently I'm a public historian. I didn't know what that word meant until very recently, but it's, you know, on one end you have academics, historians, and then on the other end you got your pop historians, and in the middle you have people like me who want to teach people and want to provide them with rigorous scholarly information, but do it in a way that is fun and accessible. Public historians are people like museum curators or documentary filmmakers. Ken Burns is a great example of a public historian. I think some of his documentaries are, they delve into bourgeois garbage ideology, but they are highly entertaining and very well produced. So I don't know. There's big plans for the future. I have energy. I've been battling depression really badly for the last several years, and I have a history of trauma and PTSD and a number of other things that I've been dealing with. So those of you who maybe I've, you know, communicated with and not been able to keep up communication, loose ends, whatever, the people who on my Patreon who were donating for a while, who I wasn't really living up to what I had outlined in my Patreon as far as rewards and keeping in touch and engaging with the audience. You know, they didn't come from a place of not caring. It really has been coming from a place of mental health and behavioral health struggles that I've been dealing with for a very long time, but they have been especially hard lately. But it's... This past week and a half, again, it started off being highly stressful, but and there's so much to come, and I don't want to make any assumptions or give anybody false hope, but I can just say that and I hope that many of you who suffer with mental illness of any kind are experiencing something similar, but I think I'm starting to understand what it's like to not feel constant alienation and to not constantly feel depressed and scared. And that's been just incredibly empowering. So I hope those of you, I mean, even those of you who don't have any sort of mental illness, I mean, I don't think you people really exist. I think all of us are a little effed up to some extent. But yeah, I'm rambling now, but I think you know what I'm trying to say. Thank you for your patience, audience. There's a flurry of information coming your way. Please support the show, patreon.com/movementspod. Please tell people about this content. This is much about me doing an entertaining podcast as it is about me. We did a webinar on how to stop bleeding because me and a Navy, ex-US Navy physician who treated combat wounds in Afghanistan, he reached out to me and he was like, you've been talking about the possibility of civil war and I'm worried it's going to happen. We need to do something because if the bullets start flying, we need to give people the tools that they need to buy time so that we can stay alive in this fight. And thank God, what the worst case scenario we were thinking of has not happened. It seems that the movement has won the first round. But again, this isn't just a show. This isn't just something that you listen to entertain yourself and learn. We are here to prepare everybody to the best of our abilities. As always, please email movementspod@gmail.com. If you have questions or want me to talk about a particular topic or need recommendations, it is my job to educate you as a Guatemalan public historian. So I'm here for you. Solidarity. And with that, this is my conversation with Doug Ina Green. One last thing I should mention. I kind of had some issues with the microphone at the beginning of the interview. I kind of fixed it midway through. It'll sound a little funny for a while, but the sound quality will improve. I'm just moving a mile a minute. What can I say? Anyway, enjoy the interview. Today on Stalling for Time, I'm joined by Doug, a Marxist historian and researcher, and someone who I've been following for the last several years and learning a lot from, and someone whose perspective I find very, very valuable to talk today about Michael Harrington, the founder of Democratic Socialists of America. Doug, thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on today.
Could you talk about yourself a little bit and let the listener know a little bit about your background and your research?
Sure. So just to be kind of succinct, I've been a Marxist since the late 90s. I have two history degrees. I live in the greater Boston area, and I was active in the Occupy movement and a few organizations. I'm currently not active, but I do a lot of research and historical writing on everything from Gramsci to Soviet Trotskyism to writing. I have a book out on the French communist Louis-Auguste Blanqui named Communist Insurgent Blanqui's Theory of Revolution, available from Haymarket Books. And all my writing can be found on my blog, blanquist.blogspot.
Great. Thank you so much, Doug. So I wanted to take some time and, you know, obviously, when everybody, all the audience is listening to this, we are sort of entering a bit of a new period in American politics, if I may be so bold as to say. It's impossible, especially, I think, as historians, we know that you don't want to bet any money on predicting on what's going to happen next. We know better than that. I personally feel safe to say that a lot of things are out of the bottle that you just that are just not going to be able to go be put back in. And I think a lot of people listening right now who may have been interested in revolutionary history and movement building and anti-fascist movements and all that sort of thing, may have been thinking this day could come someday, but it's probably a bit far off. And now, after nearly 12 days of this unprecedented national uprising, are now thinking, "Oh my gosh, is it happening?
Is it really happening? And I would say to folks that, you know, we don't want to make any assumptions about what's coming next. But I do think that it is worth learning about when you are in these sorts of pre-revolutionary moments, and revolutionary processes, of course, take years to play out. It's important for us to learn what are the roles historically of revolutionaries, of reformists, of liberals, of social democrats, you know, terms that I think some folks might think are archaic, but I strongly disagree. And I say, well, maybe some of the terminology and the cultural and economic differences have changed. I believe that sort of some of the fundamentals of how power works remain the same. So with that intro, Doug, tell us who is Michael Harrington and why should we care?
Okay. So Michael Harrington is probably the most important democratic socialist of the latter half of the 20th century in the United States. He lived from 1928 to 1989. He is most famous for a few things, one of which is writing the book The Other America in the early 60s, which had a very big influence on the War on Poverty and the Great Society. And he's also very important because he was the founder of Democratic Socialists of America. And the reason why we should care about Harrington and his ideas is because Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, is currently the largest nominal socialist organization in the United States. Has about 66,000 members, at least last I heard, and has a number of people in office, in various state offices and congressional offices, who are also members of the Democratic Party. So the fact is, DSA is setting a lot of tones for debates and setting a lot of standards on, you know, current left lingo, strategy, and whatnot. Understanding their founder and what he believed and made his impact, I think, is very important for the current day, because I don't think his ideas have quite left DSA.
Right. So why don't you tell us a little bit? So I did a little bit of research, not as much as I probably should have, a bad host over here. One of the things that I was struck by the origins in the life of Michael Harrington was the fact that he had some interesting early links to Max Shakman, who a former communist and Trotskyist who wound up becoming his most political mentor. And there is this, I noticed what you wrote in the piece on your blog that, there was a brief period where Michael Harrington, as he entered the socialist movement in the mid-50s, briefly opposed, took the anti-imperialist side, opposed the Korean War. But then as I keep reading about his career, he just consistently seems to take some really bad positions on a number of things, including Vietnam. So could you tell us a little bit about his political origins and influences political positions during the sort of revolutionary movements of the 60s?
Sure. So Harrington, he comes from an Irish Catholic background in Missouri, and he's fairly affluent, like upper middle class. He's not really affected by the Great Depression, and he's a Catholic more or less until the early 50s. He even spends a bit of time in bohemian circles in New York. He has dreams of being a poet, but he becomes really politically active in the Catholic worker movement, which, as he says, is as far left as you can go in the church. And in the early 50s, he eventually abandons Catholicism, becomes an atheist and a socialist, joining briefly the Socialist Party of America, and even opposes the Korean War on pacifistic grounds, which puts him at odds with the Socialist Party, which is supporting the war. And he leaves the Socialist Party to join the Independent Socialist League, which is led by Max Shakman. Shakman had been one of the founders of the Communist Party. He was an early Trotskyist. He broke with Trotsky in 1940. By the time Harrington is joining with Shakman, Shakman has left behind a self-identification with Trotskyism and Leninism, and he's moving in a very rightward direction, very anti-communist, and Shakman is starting to do work in the Democratic Party. And he develops these ideas called realignment, which is essentially to transform the Democratic Party. With Shachtman, those ideas are very crude and underdeveloped. Harrington takes them and really synthesizes them and makes them into like a whole political strategy over the course of his life. Now, eventually, by the end of the 50s, the Shachtmanites, they decide to fuse again with the Socialist Party, which is kind of an old dying party under Norman Thomas, who... So they actually fuse. The Shachtmanites dissolve themselves. And because the Socialist Party is kind of so much of an empty shell that Shachtman and Harrington essentially are in the saddle. So they enter the 60s in a period hoping to take leadership over the left, because the Communist Party has essentially collapsed after the Khrushchev report. And you're starting to see the civil rights movement coming into action. You're seeing student movements. And Harrington is actually involved in a very important student movement called the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, mm-hmm. which is the big student organization of the 60s. People like Tom Hayden write what is their founding document called the Port Huron Statement, which Harrington has a hand in it. You see his ideas appear in work in the Democratic Party, supporting labor unions, civil rights. But Harrington actually really does, he basically puts the SDS leaders on trial for the Port Huron Statement because to him it was insufficiently anti-communist. It blamed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union equally for the Cold War. But it was also very unsparing in its criticism of U.S. support for foreign dictators and whatnot. And Harrington would have none of this. And eventually, as the 60s wore on, Harrington and SDS patch up for a little while. But by the time the 60s wear on and you have the Vietnam War, Harrington, let's be clear, I think there's kind of a sterile debate when it comes to Harrington and the Vietnam War, whether or not he supported it. His on-paper position is very clear. He is opposed to the Vietnam War. But the question is, and so that's not really the issue with me. The issue is how he opposes the Vietnam War. Basically, for him, as someone who by the mid-60s is involved in the Democratic Party, he believes that you need to influence the liberals and the establishment parts of the Democratic Party because he supports things like the Great Society program. He doesn't want to alienate them. He wants their support to build some kind of grand coalition. So to do that, you can't have rowdy people in the streets. You can't have militancy. And you have to, you know, make sure that the politics are very respectable. So you can't have communists involved in your anti-war movement. You can't have anyone who blames the United States for supporting the war. So basically, the anti-war movement has to be kept well within bounds. And basically, this amounts to, in practice, policing the anti-war movement in such a way that things like burning draft cards or actually doing anything effectively to oppose the war is verbatim. You can't do that.
Let me get that straight. He was opposed to burning draft cards. And we're not even talking about we're not even talking about throwing a brick at like a police vehicle or anything like that. Just doing
anything illegally opposed.
That's stunning. Sorry, continue.
Oh, I'm just saying. Basically, he was opposed to war, just opposed to also doing anything effective to end it. Because if it's being conducted by the Democrats, that puts him in quite a quandary. Because he doesn't want to lose he wants to be able to whisper in their ear, to tell them about some great policy things on how to fight poverty while they're funneling millions, tens of millions into the war in Southeast Asia.
So
he doesn't want that.
If I may sort of interrupt for a moment, I sort of what I'm getting from this is what I think is interesting. So I initially at the top of this, I said that he had taken the anti-imperialist position that one time on Korea, but you mentioned that it was actually more of a pacifist position, which I think, as you said that, it sort of clicked with me something that I hadn't thought before, which is that Michael Harrington, in many ways, to my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, seemed more interested in sort of abstract idealism than actually really analyzing the situation and actually analyzing the relationships of power, leverages of power, as you say, by opposing things that were effective, that could have actually, you know, helped to end the war or scuttle the war effort, and instead in this role of policing the left from this, you know, almost moralistic perspective. And then the other thing I want that I want to get your thoughts on or whatnot was that he, in terms of, you know, I think one of the things that folks sometimes have a hard time with is, you know, there have been alleviations of suffering, benefits that people have received as a result of policies enacted by the Democratic Party. And I'm sure that someone like Michael Harrington probably took a great deal of satisfaction knowing that, you know, by, you know, working on a campaign that worked with Democrats that passed something, that was something that really helped people. But I think what's the subtle distinction here is that his efforts were not in terms of leveraging, were not in terms of demanding, and were not in terms of trying to strong-arm capital or capitalist parties, but rather to divert resources into them. So creating a situation where, yes, there were some short-term gains that were gotten, but in the long term, at the end of the process, he actually alienated, isolated, and rendered impotent much of the left. What is your thoughts to my radical statement there?
Yeah, so a few things. So the Shachtmanites that he joined, they actually were fairly supportive of a lot of anti-colonial movements, including Vietnam, I should say, and Ho Chi Minh, mm-hmm. in the 40s and 50s. That really kind of died away as the 50s wore on, as an anti-communism became much more prevalent. And Harrington himself wouldn't be caught, to put it bluntly, he wouldn't be caught dead supporting any anti-imperialist struggle if it was led by any form of communist or Marxist. He was always concerned that he would feel some kind of totalitarian impulse to support, say, something like the Sandinistas later on as well. So he believes, let me talk a little about realignment, because it's what he develops. Basically, he understands the United States has essentially two major capitalist parties. You have the Republican Party, which is clearly the party of big business. And Harrington believes that the Democratic Party has capitalists and racists in it as well, like the Dixiecrats, the Southern segregationists. But it also has labor unions supporting it, like the AFL-CIO. It has a lot of civil rights folks and all these other kind of new social movements that, you know, bubble up in the 60s and 70s, women's movement, anti-war, whatnot. What he wants to do, to put it succinctly, is he wants all the capitalists and the racists to go over to the Republican Party, and the Democrats will transform or realign into a European-style social democratic party, which will eventually, through means that have made no sense to me, enact a lot of socialist reforms and lead to a Scandinavian-style socialism, and somehow, in other ways that I don't understand, lead to actual socialism. And this means, but he, so on the one hand, he prioritizes work within the Democratic Party. It's kind of an inside-outside strategy, because he does conceive of the Socialist Party that he's the leader of as operating on the outside. But the thing is, he ultimately, and this is the rock that every inside-outside strategy comes up against, in order to stay on the inside, you have to sacrifice the outside, mm-hmm. which means he prioritizes all this work in working with Democratic politicians on trying to nudge them here and there. He has no leverage to do anything. He's mostly just kind of a fly, you know, on their arm, if anything. They might notice him. They might throw him a few rhetorical bones, but they don't really do much. And I don't think he really has any understanding on, you know, balances of class power, how the state really works. To put it bluntly, I think most of his election articles on why we need to support the Democrats are almost always the same. You just change a few names around, and it could be the same every 4 years. Most important election in our lifetime. The Republicans are the party of big business. We have our power at the ballot. Workers, you know, are going to gain from the Democrats and whatnot. And it's true that, you know, that some of the social programs, whether in the New Deal or the Great Society, had tangible benefits on, you know, whatever it is, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and whatnot. But I think it's also kind of clear as well, it's not just like these Democrats are like really nice people who just like really want to provide for the people. A lot of these come from like genuine social movements who are pushing for things, and these are concessions from above.
Yes.
And you saw that, you know, with the labor strikes in the 30s, and you see that with the civil rights and the student movements in the 60s and 70s, who really do push a lot of these. And they manage to get these concessions. And we can talk about how limited they are and whatnot, but it's not because Democrats are nice people. It's because you actually have movements and that are pushing for things, and these are concessions granted to those movements.
So the next thing I want to check in, actually, I wanted to clarify. I think I said earlier that he was the founder of DSA, but I think he was he or was he not? Could you clarify that for me?
Oh, absolutely. He was the founder.
He was the founder. Okay. DSA. I wasn't sure if he just was the, you know, the grandfather or the founder, but thank you for clarifying. So tell us a little bit about I think we got up to Vietnam. You told us a little bit about realignment and that political strategy. Why don't you continue the timeline and continue telling us about his life and political career?
Sure. So Harrington, by the mid-60s, he's a fairly prominent figure because The Other America is a great liberal expose of poverty. I actually recommend reading it. It's not a Marxist or socialist text. You have to read it as like a liberal, moralistic sociology text. In that sense, it's actually a decent read. You can read it in an afternoon about all the things people suffer. So he's fairly well known because of that, which influences the Great Society. But as the 60s wear on, he wants essentially the moderate element. He wants to win over elements of the New Left away from these extremist revolutionary policies and everything. He doesn't want things like the Black Panthers or the new communist movement. He wants everyone to kind of come around and to, you know, get under the banner of realignment and push the Democrats to the left, which of course means he's trying to do whatever he can to stamp out these fires of radicalism that are really picking up as the 60s go on. And this puts him in a quandary because on the one hand, he is formally opposed to the Vietnam War. And his mentor, Max Shackman, is really gung-ho for it. So he's in the party with Shackman, and Shackman is essentially abandoning the original premises of realignment, identifying with the labor bureaucracy of George Meany and the AFL-CIO, who are really supporting the war and are incredibly anti-communist. So Shackman, he's more true to Shackman than Shackman. And this really comes out in sort of factional struggles that develop in the Socialist Party in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's only by the late 60s, early 70s that he comes out against the Vietnam War within the party. And I think it's important to note that he can do this because Richard Nixon was elected in 1968, a Republican. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very politically convenient for someone who identifies with the Democrats. And I think that's very important to point out.
And if I may interrupt again for a moment here, I think what resonates about that to me is, I think for myself, my journey leftward and the process that I've been on for several years now really started during the first Obama term and continued throughout the Obama years. And that specific, you know, essentially almost supporting the Vietnam War when the Democrats are doing it, and then becoming against it when the Republicans are doing it. That I felt that way about myself as, you know, I'm first generation Guatemalan American, and I have family that's undocumented and a whole history with that, you know, whole thing. And remembering how few progressives in contemporary America, activists, people I knew who were very progressive minded, people who would have called them socialists, people who would eventually get into things like DSA, who seemed completely disinterested, or at least, you know, would sort of pay lip service to the escalation and deportations that occurred under Obama and the ICE raids that were going on. The anecdote I always tell people is Thanksgiving, I want to say this was 2009 or 2010, there had just been a number of ICE raids in the general region where my family is. And my family likes to host Thanksgiving. You know, I'm not really into imperialist holidays, but I like me some turkey and tequila, which is kind of how we roll in Guatemalan families. And we had, we were hosting, but very few people showed up. A lot of people canceled and stayed home because they were afraid. They were afraid to go to Thanksgiving dinner. And this was under Obama. And many people on the left, particularly progressives, but even many people who are now socialists or say they're socialists, seem disinterested during that time. So I just wanted to interrupt and say that's one of the things that jumped out to me as, oh man, the past is now in many ways. Right. But yes, please continue with the timeline.
So as the early 70s are happening, the factional struggle within the Socialist Party is becoming very intense. Harrington gets very excited by the campaign of George McGovern, who he sees as representative of a lot of these like very soft new politics of the new left, bringing together a lot of, you know, different social movements under the banner of the Democrats. But to his opponents, people like Bayard Rustin and Max Shackman, McGovern is insufficiently anti-communist, is insufficiently anti-war. So this produces a very bizarre position in the Socialist Party, where you have the party of Eugene V. Debs, the most famous socialist in American history. Mm-hmm. This party by 1972 is split between supporting the Democrat George McGovern and other members who are more or less supporting Richard Nixon. And it gets so bad that the party essentially splits it three ways in the 1972-73. You have an earlier left-wing split led by someone who recently passed away named David McReynolds, which they were anti-war. They were more or less, you know, left-wing democratic socialists. And they formed what is currently the Socialist Party of the United States of America. That still exists. You have a middle group which renames the Socialist Party to Social Democrats USA, and they just become essentially an anti-communist think tank. That's the far right of the party. And then you have a middle, a centrist group more or less in that constellation, led by Harrington, who leaves the Socialist Party, and he forms his own group called the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, which is composed of a lot of labor bureaucrats, social democratic intellectuals, other very moderate elements of the new left. And when Harrington resigns from the Socialist Party, which he had been chairman of, he's essentially saying, I agree essentially with all the original tactics of anti-communism realignment, but you all abandon it, and I'm just going to stay true to it. So he goes off on his own and forms the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, which over the course of the 70s grows to, I believe it's like 4,000 or 5,000 members. And most of what they do is work in the Democratic Party. One thing that Harrington was very pleased with himself, in the 76 election, he helped the Democrats adopt a very progressive platform. It would supposedly complete the New Deal and the Great Society. He was very excited about it. He had Ted Kennedy on board and all this. And, you know, he was so excited for the prospects of the Jimmy Carter administration. And when Carter gets in, that plan goes away because Carter puts in austerity. There, you know, he does sort of the dry run for the Reaganite neoliberalism. And Harrington is very upset at all this, but he kind of really can't do much more than cry and attend some ineffectual protests. It gets him as far as supporting Kennedy in the 1980 Democratic primary and refusing to endorse Carter. But more or less, he's not going to break with the Democratic Party. He's still within it. At the same time, Harrington, by this point, of course, the Vietnam War has ended. A lot of the new left is you have the new communist movement who are doing their thing. But you have other elements like something called the New America Movement, which had grown out of SDS, which was originally quasi-Leninist, quasi-Third Worldist. But they moderate over the course of the 70s. They start supporting Democratic Party politicians, and they see they have a lot in common with Harrington's group. So unity negotiations occur, and in 1982, these two groups fuse. The New America Movement, which is much smaller than Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, and they fuse to form the Democratic Socialists of America. That's about 38 years ago. And Harrington is the recognized leader of this group, its most important spokesperson. And over the course of the 80s, they pretty much just support they're involved in some kind of protests against Central American intervention, they're supporting the PATCO strike to a certain degree, but their union members in DSA during that time basically refused to do anything that could be conceived of as illegal. They're willing to cross picket lines and things like that. And in 1984, it's kind of ironic that they have the best chance for realignment with the Jesse Jackson campaign, the Rainbow Coalition, that Harrington refuses to support at that time. Now, there's all kinds of limitations about Jackson, but he does have a fairly progressive...
Yeah, could you take a couple minutes and actually kind of go into a little bit of detail? Because I think that's one of those chapters in recent Democratic Party politics that... considering how important it was and how recent it was, it's actually shocking to me how few people know anything about it.
Yeah, so Jesse Jackson was probably leading, he led something called the Rainbow Coalition. He had been active in civil rights politics and whatnot in the preceding years. And he was very charismatic, very articulate spokesperson. And he's basically advancing a very social democratic style politics. He's opposed to things like intervention in Central America. He's fairly pro-Palestinian. He's fairly, willing to support the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, which is a big thing at that time. And he brings to the table, essentially, the social democratic elements within the Black liberation struggle. He brings in progressive elements of the labor movement, and he brings in, all kinds of other social movements, gay liberation, the women's movement, all these kind of, they become this rainbow coalition. And they do win some primaries, but they don't. So in many respects, I would actually argue, was far more progressive than someone like Bernie Sanders, which I think should shock people, Jesse Jackson loses the primary in 1984, and the Democrats support Walter Mondale, who's just a corporation in a suit. And Jackson, goes out campaigns for him. He makes sure to keep his followers in the Democratic Party. They're not willing, it's a very top-down, the Rainbow Coalition is very top-down. It's not any kind of party. And, of course, the Democrats lose 1984. They push a little even farther to the right, farther away from New Deal-style politics. And in 1988, Jackson runs again, but he's far more moderate. He's far more willing to play nice with big business. Harrington even offers him support. In 1988, Jackson still loses. He backs the charismatic and volatile figure of Michael Dukakis. Hopefully the irony comes out in my statement.
Yes, Commander Michael Dukakis.
I live in Massachusetts, I do know a little about Dukakis. So Jackson is kind of, to put it very bluntly, he's very much a sheepdog. He really is trying to keep the people he brings into the Democratic Party process within the party. And Harrington is, by that point in 1988, as Jackson has moderated himself to many respects. Harrington thinks that's okay. Like, he's toned down on some of the support for the Palestinians, some of the more support for black liberation, and Harrington is okay with that. But in the end, of course, Harrington supports both Mondale and Dukakis in those years. And that's actually the last election Harrington took any part in 1988. He had very severe throat cancer, and it cost him his life the following year. But his organization has continued onward.
Thank you for that introduction to Michael Harrington. So I think the logical next topic is to bring things more to present, I think. And how is that relevant today? Like, as I said earlier, it's sort of a new world compared to where when I first reached out to you, about 2.5-3 months ago about doing this. And that was right before COVID-19 hit. And then a flash forward to like just under 2 weeks ago, then the unprecedented national uprising begins. And I think something that I found that was fascinating to me is and one of the ways in which I realized how big of a deal this really was. I mean, there's so many ways in which you can say this changes everything, however much of a cliche that is. But I think the confusion and impotence of every single prominent politician in this country, and I don't say this as a way to slam, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters or people who are into, you know, AOC and the squad. I need to be honest here. I'm fairly hostile to Bernie Sanders myself. I have been, my sort of attitude towards the squad has been like, yeah, you like them now, but just wait until they actually have any power and you're going to see what these types of social Democrat politicians do. But I must admit, even myself, like, had moments where someone like Ilhan Omar, actually had a few decent positions on things like Venezuela. Some of her statements, some of her challenges during hearings towards, I'm forgetting his name. The guy who likes hiding guns in aid shipments in Central America. I'm totally forgetting his name. But
I'm forgetting it too. I know what you're thinking.
Really famous and important from the Reagan years. But in any case, despite my sort of apprehension, like, it's sort of like, all right, they haven't been tested yet. You know, they've had political successes. They understand how to communicate to people. They know how to speak to things that people care about. And I had sort of conceded, you know, for the duration of 2020 and this election, it seems like we have, you know, on the revolutionary left, we've sort of lost the debate for now. Like, people have not, and not in terms of our actual points, our actual analysis, but in terms of winning, you know, public opinion among people who should be, you know, who are in the working class base or socialist base or whatnot. And now all this has happened. And Bernie Sanders puts out his plan in which he calls for a raise for cops. And it just blew my mind, the specific logic that he used in the text, in the language that he used, that was basically amounted to, well, if we pay cops more, we can attract a higher talent pool, like a more high quality talent pool to do the job of policing. I just found that absolutely astounding. I don't have a question, Doug.
No,
that was more of a statement. I would love to get your thoughts about what the hell is going on.
Well, let me bring DSA up to the present.
Yes,
and
yes, great idea.
Hopefully, I can. So DSA at Harrington's death was, I believe, still the largest nominal socialist group, like 6,000 or so members. I forget the exact figure. But like every group, it suffered, you know, from the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union. And they kind of limped through the 90s. And they're largely this paper membership. They do have some union members. I believe even New York Mayor David Dinkins was a member. I'm not sure what he did to advance socialism, though. And they've, you know, more or less have supported the Democratic Party candidates. Sometimes they're willing to, you know, maybe look kindly on someone like Ralph Nader or whomever, but they're very ensconced in electoral politics. And I'm just going to, I'm really skipping through like 20 years of history here, but things start to change with them in 2011. They do attract some very talented younger people, one of whom is named Bhaskar Sankara. So it's around 2010, 11, about he founds a magazine called Jacobin, which has since grown to the most, one of the most well-read and popular magazines on the very broadly speaking American left. And he cites Harrington as an influence. Sankara himself, you know, one of his inspirations was Michael Harrington. A lot of Jacobin is not an official DSA org. And they, I've been published, you know, twice in them. Mm-hmm. But let's be clear: in general, they support DSA positions. A lot of their writers are DSA. They bring in every now and then some more Marxist-oriented people. So that's something that is important. And in 2016, DSA probably had the very most clear position on the Sanders campaign in terms of many other left groups that were supporting him. Other left groups would say, we're supporting, but we're not endorsing, which is like very schizophrenic. And DSA is like, listen, we like Sanders. We like what he supports, his kind of, you know, New Deal, which where they were calling democratic socialism, and we're going to campaign for him. So that does a lot of good for them. They're able to recruit a bunch of people. And after Donald Trump gets elected, they recruit even more people. And they go, again, this jumps up over for the last 4 years from like 8,000 to 66,000. They have elected people in state offices. I had someone in Virginia, I think, state house or representative named Lee Carter. They have AOC, who I'm not exactly sure what her current relationship is with DSA, but she's very much identified and supported by them. She's in Congress, and they supported Sanders again in 2020. And it's important to note, you know, supposedly I was told that DSA, you know, since this membership bump, has become very open. Its politics have changed. I don't really think that's true. You do see people in DSA who, you know, coming from previous left groups, new people coming in. You have seen, you know, people who have study groups on Trotsky or whatnot. That's true. And you see all kinds of caucuses in there. There are some caucuses in there that are very much like, you know, straight up, like we like Michael Harrington and whatnot. But most people in DSA do not refer to Harrington. Like if you're in a Trotskyist group, someone will say, you know, Trotsky said this and that and you know, and a Maoist group would do the same thing. Mao said this and that. You know, you see that. They don't operate that way. You don't see Harrington like that kind of reference point. But that, and I see people say that, you know, most people in DSA so don't know who he is, so therefore his legacy is gone. Well, that's not really the case.
Yeah.
The case is DSA is very much, they have currently 100 or so members in the Democratic Party, elected members. That's still that orientation. They have something, a policy they're pursuing. The last convention they had, they adopted called the Dirty Break, where they're going to use the Democratic Party ballot line, because for them it's just an empty vessel, elect a bunch of people as socialists, and somehow down the line break with them. Well, that kind of vanished when, you know, you see within the last year, they just went all in for Sanders, all in for AOC and all these people. And even the people who are like Bhaskar Sankara, who are saying, oh, we can support Howie Hawkins. For him, it's really kind of an empty gesture because he's doing it in a state the Democrats are going to win. And he still has expressed said, like, listen, I still want Joe Biden to win. So the dirty break is kind of gone.
Before we move on from the dirty break, I wanted to actually relate this to something, and I didn't prepare to talk about this specifically, but you just reminded me of, and this was from an individual who, as far as I know, is not DSA, is someone who I do respect, who considers themselves a Leninist who supported Bernie Sanders. And I know you're familiar with that being a phenomenon of Marxists who supported Bernie Sanders, both 2016 and in 2020. We kind of got into it a little bit one time because, you know, there's a few reasons, but the sort of crux of his argument was he told me to read Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder by Vladimir Lenin, which is a document that in the Russian Revolution series that I concluded earlier this year, I never really talked about, but was an important document, really, really important document in Russia among the Bolsheviks, but also worldwide to the entire movement. And he specifically pointed towards the chapter on I believe it was, and you know, this is, I'm not an ex, I haven't read this document enough. I've read through it once, and I'm not an expert on it by any means, but I believe it was the chapter on British, like the British Labour Party and the sort of development of the modern British Labour Party and socialists trying to decide, do they participate in the party? Do they not participate in the party? That sort of thing. And you know, Lenin, who, based on my reading of the text, his sort of point was not so much, it certainly wasn't always engage in electoral politics. It was not always disengage and abstain from electoral politics. It was, it's going to depend on the specifics of the situation. Sometimes it makes sense. Sometimes it doesn't. You need to know why you're doing it and what your end goal is. But as far as I could tell when I read that chapter, I couldn't understand what point he was making in terms of how this meant we should work on why it made sense to support the Democratic Party. Would you be able to talk to that, and if possible, that specific British example? And I apologize. I know I didn't ask you about this ahead of time. So if we have to wing it or move on, that's fine too.
Okay. I've actually written a few articles on Lenin's left-wing communism. So that's written in 1920. It's actually written for the Comintern Second Congress that was held that summer. And it's basically, there's all these kind of left communist people.
And the Comintern is?
Oh, the Communist International. It's essentially an international organization of communists that's trying to form parties around the world. And in these new communist parties, because the parties are very new at this point, there's a lot of these people who are very eager to just have revolutionary action, no compromise, storm the barricades. Mm-hmm. And Lenin is writing this saying, listen, you got to actually, you know, you have an infantile disorder. You need to outgrow it. That's how he's looking at. He's trying to win them over to a more serious and principled revolutionary politics and strategy, to be able to intervene in a situation that he thought had revolutionary potential, to use these opportunities to build communist parties. So that means being involved in labor unions, even if they're reactionary, supporting these kind of social democratic or labor parties. In Britain, it meant, you know, if you can affiliate to the Labor Party, which was a nominally socialist party, a nominally workers' party, you should. And you should try and get people in, but make sure you tell the truth and support them the way a rope supports a hanging man. But it's important to know. Yeah, that's the analogy he uses.
I love Lenin's writing. Oh, man.
Yes, so do I.
He's a snarky little asshole, and I love it.
Yeah, he is. But it's important to know, this is not just – he's not talking about just getting into parties, you know, getting into elections for the sake of elections. He's like, listen, if you're going to get into elections – He's writing this document so communists can effectively combat opportunism, not be opportunists.
And can you explain what opportunism is?
Opportunism is basically abandoning any form of principle for a perceived short-term gain. So basically, he's like, if you get into parliamentary office, you're going to use that. You can use that to spread your message and propaganda. You can use that to expose like how rotten this system is, to make to make speeches. And he's not. Now, when it comes to the Democratic Party, I've read the Left-Wing Communism multiple times. he's talking at most about being involved in critically supporting, say, a social democratic party or politicians in those parties. He's not saying support Democratic Party, which is a capitalist party, lock, stock, and barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And the Labour Party of 100 years ago is not the Democratic Party of today. And it should also be noted, he's not talking about just supporting these candidates. He wants to be involved in these kind of politics to build communist politics and communist parties.
I have a question, actually, as to the question of what is the difference between a labor or workers, like a socialist party of some kind, and a capitalist, like a left-leaning-ish kind of capitalist party. Because I think, you know, even though I think folks of our particular shade of red would be highly critical and consider social democratic politics after 1914 to essentially be the enemy to some extent, at least. And yet they were still, they still had some sort of working class base, ties to labor unions, that sort of thing. So could you explain maybe like what, for, in a practical way, are, how would our listeners sort of look at a political party and tell the difference that, okay, this is a workers' party, this is a, you know, a socialist party that is kind of nominally a workers' party, and this is a straight-up bourgeois party that we shouldn't even be touching? Sure.
So there's a few criteria I would use. You can look at parties partly in terms of their membership base. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these social democratic parties have a lot of workers in them. Then you can say so do the Democrat Party in the United States. And you can look at the leading cadres in those said parties. So you can actually have local Democratic Party officials be workers, union members or whatnot, the same as you could in social democratic parties. But you also have to look at the program. So until at least the 50s, in many cases, a lot of social democratic and labor parties had the eventual end goal of socialism. Obviously, their tactics were not that. They were not, they were just were managing capitalism. The Democratic Party has never had a program of any sort committed to socialism, but to the defense of private property and imperialism. It's never been on the table.
So would you would you say that?
And of course,
go ahead.
I was also going to say the Democratic Party is also controlled lock, stock, and barrel by capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
So,
so would you say, because I think my, I think the, and he and I, we had a little bit of a tiff, and at some point we need to chat about it as comrades, and I look forward to that day. So if you're listening, you know, I'll text you sometime. I think sort of my understanding of what his point was to sort of equate the, you know, the Bernie Sanders campaign and primary to, you know, being involved in a labor party, even if it was dominated by opportunists and labor bureaucrats. And like you said, you know, being honest about what's going on, the rope to tie the noose, but still engaging with those workers. And to what extent do you think would that have been possible to do that within the Bernie Sanders campaign? And what was the fundamental flaw of that strategy for people who consider themselves revolutionary Marxists?
I don't think it was done. I don't think it was possible to do. I'll take the example of Jacobin, a supposedly nominal socialist publication that in 2019 published 340 articles on Bernie Sanders and his campaign. Not one of them had criticism. Not one of them talked about his actual record in supporting imperialism and supporting apartheid Israel. And essentially that's all because the logic of elections in this case is just to win, to have your guy get in. They're not going to bring up those uncomfortable truths. Lenin, I think, is very clear. You know, you tell the truth. You're not going to just shield it for the sake of expediency because that's going to bite you in the butt of, in the, you know, pretty sooner or later. And you essentially had a lot of people getting involved in this campaign, whether, you know, I'm talking about people who consider themselves socialists who are basically making excuses for someone who has voted continually for military budgets, who calls the cops on protesters, who does all that. And I'm not sure what the organization was that was there to support I was told there was this Bernie Sanders movement. I don't know what it was. I mean, was it just people who showed up to the poll on election day? Well, they're gone now.
I think what to is some there extent, to be a little generous here, I would say that my sort of feeling is that, because I think there are a lot of people who latched on to the Bernie Sanders campaign and went out to vote for him who may have been very disengaged from politics before. And I can see there being some value in that. But my sort of concern was like, that is, and again, I feel like I'm being a little generous here, that was such a baby step. And the value, if anything, of the Bernie Sanders campaign was to immediately disappoint everybody in the most unpredictable of ways. Because, you know, I think Bernie Sanders, give him enough time and power, will disappoint you, you know, just by being Bernie Sanders and, you know, the police are socialist. I mean, I think he said that in 2016 when he was doing his speech about everything the government does is socialist, including the police. That's a statement that did not age well. You know, so I think eventually he was going to disappoint people, and as Obama disappointed me and led me on this journey. But this perfect storm of the campaign being scuttled, and the way that the Democratic Party fought harder against, honestly, their best opportunity they could have had. If they had tried to embrace and co-opt him this primary rather than just pull out all the stops to defeat him and nominate or prepare to nominate a rapist, I think it's very easily they could have, right? So let's say that had been the situation. Bernie Sanders had his delegates. He was on his way to win a nomination and this uprising happened. I don't think you would have seen nearly as many middle-class, white, petty bourgeois folks. And, you know, granted, I think a lot of this election showed that there were a lot of working class people of color who supported Bernie Sanders, Latinos especially. But because, you know, he seemed like the only game in town. But right now we have this multiracial movement being led by the black working class, currently very decentralized, but very multiracial with a significant amount of support, even from the middle class. Or at least the left and progressive middle class. And I'm just imagining if Bernie Sanders was on his way to becoming the nominee. Well, let me ask you, what do you think would have been the difference between that timeline and now?
That's very hard to say because, you know, we've had COVID. Now we have this whole uprising. I think he would have been trying to He probably would have offered more or less the same reforms that he's offered now, including the pay raise. And I think he would have, if he had, you know, his supporters who were in these movements would probably, I think, in many respects, especially if they were in any way organized with the Democratic Party, would try and siphon people back into that process.
Right.
He's not someone who likes, you know, militancy in the streets. He wants militancy to go to the polling booths and into the Democratic Party. And that's kind of the thing that's like the fundamental problem with this operation in the Democratic operating in the Democratic Party. If you want to get that far ahead, if you want to get into office, be the nominee, you have to play by their rules. And their rules are not those of extra parliamentary street actions. Those are the politics of backroom deals, of, you know, gentlemen's agreements and whatnot. And, you know, people who act as firemen for those who don't like fires. That's like what official unions do, you know, the labor bureaucracy to, you know, to anyone who gets out of line.
Right.
Or, you know, NGOs. No, don't do this communist shit. You want to do this in the polls. You want to have serious politics in the Democratic Party.
I think one of the things that I've sort of been sort of, or the references that I've been making and in the series, so I think most of the people listening to this right now have probably listened to the Russian Revolution series that I produced by now. And we spent in that series a significant amount of time talking about the German Revolution and talking about the Freikorps and the role of the Social Democrats in organizing the purge of the left. And I think one of the things that I've been saying to people is that, okay, so you know, the meme of Bernie Sanders killed Rosa Luxemburg. Okay, you know, maybe Bernie Sanders isn't as equivalent to, you know, Nosk and all those other guys. I'm not quite as familiar with that history. I was mostly just trying to give context for the larger context for, mm-hmm. for what was going on at the time. But you know, Bernie Sanders, maybe he's not as scummy as those people for the sake of argument. But I've been saying, like, the people who go down the social democratic role or the, you know, revolution by the ballot box, those people either become the people who kill Rosa Luxemburg or they become Salvador Allende in 1973, refusing to give arms to the workers who are saying, hey, you guy, there's gonna be a coup. There already was a few coup attempts. You know this. Give us guns, please. You know, I think that's one of the things that I want to get across to people today as we look forward. Because I think right now there's a certain energy and optimism that there's been a number of victories and even some small but previously unthinkable concessions being discussed right now all across the country. And I think there's a certain excitement right now, but I think I also want to communicate to the listeners here today that we also need to be prepared that just because a revolutionary movement or whatnot seems like it's on the march, there are things we need to be very, very careful about in terms of where we channel that energy. This is more of a statement than a question. I apologize, Doug.
It's okay. I mean, yeah, so I actually think there are three options if we're talking about social democracy. You mentioned two of them. Mm. Nosk, who's yes. going to be your, you know, your right wing, your death squad, who's going to kill the revolutionaries on behalf of the bourgeois state. Your Allende, who's the very principled democratic socialist, but who is blinded by illusions on how power really works,
right.
and ultimately leads you to death. The other one is your Mitterrand, who is a French president. He led a socialist government in the 80s that essentially had all these ambitions for sweeping programs, but you know the capital rattles its saber just a bit. They renege on it, and they're the ones instituting austerity. They brought in like all kinds of enthusiasm and energy, and it kind of goes away because you know it's kind of sucked into this horrible situation of like their supposed guys in office are the ones carrying out like attacks on pensions and union rights and whatever. So I wanted to also just add like, so what we're seeing now is just, you know, this is a little bit away from Harrington, Sanders and whatnot, but with these uprisings, you're seeing a lot of this elemental anger, you know, in urban centers in 50 states, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
and there's really no organization, as far as I know. There might be local or whatnot. I haven't really investigated to give you a straight answer on that. But it's interesting, and it brings to mind a Trotsky quote. It's one of his famous from History of the Russian Revolution that, you know, esteem has energy, I'm paraphrasing it, and it drives a piston, you know, the piston channels the steam, but without the steam, the piston can't do anything. So it kind of show, you know, if we actually had like a left, a real revolutionary left that was national, had its act together, and that was really on the ground in these places, it could really, you know, help move things along. I think maybe give some, you know, it would obviously be like a dialectical relationship of learning and not just like telling people what to do and whatnot. And it's kind of showing that like the supposed largest, socialist left group in the United States has spent the last 5 years in one way or another campaigning for Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And I know some of their people are at these protests. I'm not taking that away, but
right.
they're really absent. It just kind of shows you like, it was that where our energies as the left, you know, very broadly speaking, should have been, you know, right. getting politicians into office.
Hey, Doug, you there?
When? Yes.
You dropped out a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can hear you fine.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think I lost you for like about 5 seconds. So could you back up a little bit?
I was basically you have the large group DSA that spent the last 5 years campaigning for Sanders in one way or another, and other Democrats. But that's all they do. They're just a vote catching organization. They want to elect progressive or democratic socialists through the Democratic Party and not engage in extra parliamentary action of whatever sort, at least not, you know, on the whole. And it just kind of shows like these are very different conceptions of politics. Right. Harrington would be fine with all the electoral stuff. And that's really, you know, not how change happens. Change happens in the streets, in the workplaces, and, you know, and whatever. And if you're going to actually run in office, you know, it's a secondary or tertiary thing to that. And it's done through an independent, you know, working class organization, not as an adjunct of the Democratic Party.
Indeed. So I think we are coming to time here. I'm pretty thrilled with how this conversation has gone, especially considering I was not very good at being preparing for it, but it's been a hell of a week. What can I say?
It's okay. All of us.
Are there any last thoughts that you wanted to share with the listeners?
So just a few things. I'm not sure when this will be up, but I hope it comes across that I've written a book on this. It hasn't been accepted by a publisher yet. I'm hoping soon something will happen. If it does, I'll let you know. But this is actually a biography. It's not just me talking out in space and whatnot. So I'm really hoping that's coming out. And for your listeners, I have an upcoming piece out on something completely different than this, which is the Hungarian Soviet Republic of 1919. I'm hoping that comes out in a few weeks. And a friend of mine and I are working on a series on Marxism and the Enlightenment, which will hopefully be out by Bastille Day, but I can't promise that.
And I just want to add, so I think, yeah, you mentioned Communist Insurgent at the top of the show, so you already have that published, that book.
Mm-hmm.
But I also just wanted to say one of my personal pieces of your, personal favorite pieces of yours was about Trotsky's part in forming the Red Army, which has the most... Mm-hmm. badass title of like any article I've ever read. It was what was the title of that one, if you remember?
It's the Communist Order of Samurai.
It's a great,
which is actually a quote from Trotsky. It's so good I had to use it.
It's a great piece. I'm gonna make sure that I include that in the link in the description when I publish this episode. One of my favorite pieces that you've ever written.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Doug. I'm so, so glad that we were able to have this conversation. And in some ways, I'm almost glad that we didn't end up having this conversation until this week, because I feel like...
No, me too.
It would have been... If we had done this conversation 2 weeks ago, it would have been obsolete very quickly. And, yes. Well, not entirely, but in some ways would have been like, guess we should do another. But thank you so much for joining Stalin for Time.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
I cannot stress enough how excited I am Doug came onto the show. I want to encourage everybody to look up Doug's blog, blankist.blogspot.com. That's blanquist.blogspot.com. You can also find his writing at leftvoice.org. That's leftvoice.org. They're one of my favorite, and probably my top favorite Marxist or socialist magazine, online or otherwise, in the United States. There's a bunch of Doug's writing there. And also, as I mentioned earlier, my personal favorite of Doug's work, Communist Order of Samurai, Leon Trotsky and the Red Army, which is especially for those of you who are interested in more military history or guerrilla like forces or that transform themselves into disciplined proper armies. This is just a fantastic read. You can find that on links.org.au/node. That's NODE/4691. That was really long, but or you can just Google The Communist Order of Samurai, Leon Trotsky and the Red Army by Doug Ina Green, published at Links International Journal of Socialist Renewal. And with that, I guess here comes the outro. The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. Support the show by donating at patreon.com/movementspod. Special thanks to Time for intro and outro music. Listen to Break the State and other songs by Time on Spotify and SoundCloud. Educate the soul, the elite eat caviar's bodies explode. And like a sweatshop, they don't reap what they sow. The state is homophobic because the state is religious. That's why they use the Bible to slaughter the indigenous. It ain't man versus nature, it's money versus everything. Greed gave Mother Nature radioactive wedding ring. Old mother's dying, we're almost out of time. So watch me disappear like Palestine. If you work every day, break the state. If you don't make a living wage, break the state. Every day there's more debt, break the state. They arrest you at the protest, break the state. If there's drones over your home, break the state. If they foreclose on your loan, break the state.